Hello, and welcome to another episode of Talking with the Wounded with me, your host, Ben Stevens. Today's episode, or show, I'd like to call it a show because this should be a show. So if you're out there and you make shows, BBC or anyone else who produces shows, you should be making this a show because these are amazing people and they're fascinating stories and they're a good listen and would be an even better watch. Anyway, today's show is very special. One, because we've gone back to the Grenadier Guards. So apologies for those of you who are sick of hearing Grenadier Guards stories, but here is one more. But this one is very, very different from the others. The events that led to my guest's injuries are very different from the other ones you would have heard, and also life subsequently and the things that he's done, as well as being inspirational and truly amazing, are also very, very different and not the expected path that you would think of somebody with his injuries doing. My guest today is a chap called Scott Blaney. Scott, thank you very much for welcoming me into your home and doing this. I'm going to try and divide this into two, if I may. First half, we're going to focus on the events that led to you being in the shape that you're in today. And then the second half on all the amazing things that you've done post your injury. Is that all right?
Perfect.
For the benefit of the listener, I'm just going to summarise very quickly Scott's military career. Basically, you joined the Grenadier Guards in 2004 and you left in 2016.
I did.
But the weird thing about your story is that you were injured in 2007.
I was, yeah.
So you managed to somehow stay in the military system for a long time afterwards in the tribe, which we'll talk about in a minute. So that's very different. But first of all, let's go back to, I think you said the 26th of May. Some ambiguity over it because it was in the middle of the night or it was such a shit show that it took a long time to sort out. 26th, 27th of May. If you could take us back to that moment, and we'll start there. If you could describe for us what you're doing, what's your job, what's the purpose of the patrol, and then subsequently the events that lead to you being how you are today.
So yeah, so it was May 2007 and the guards have just been attached to the Royal Anglians to go to Afghanistan in Southern Helmand province, in a place called Garmsir, which has become quite famous now. I think there's lots of books and everything that have covered that sort of area and the firefights that were going on down there. So we'd gone down there as 3 company. So we took over from the Marines. It would have been around about February time that we was deployed. And then went out there. I was 20 years old. I mean, a young guardsman. And we were basically there to hold the ground. And if I'm honest, it sounds quite bad, but I didn't know what I was doing. It was my first deployment. I was just there and had the rifle and I was a GPMG gunner because I was quite well built and I could carry a bit of weight. And I was just put in the middle of the desert and told, this is what we're doing. We're going to hold these checkpoints. And
everybody's the same.
Yeah, everyone's the same, yeah. And it was just get out there and if you see anything, you put brass into it. And that was basically what we'd been told. And at that point, when I first joined up, we knew about obviously 9/11 and what had gone on and what the Americans were doing in Afghanistan and vice versa. So we went up there with the instincts that we were doing good and we was in a village in Garmsir where we was trying to repopulise with the Afghan civilians. It was my end of the story that I thought what was going on. And
you're making the place better. A better community for the locals to get on with their lives.
Yeah.
And keep the Taliban at bay.
Exactly.
Building schools, libraries, wells.
Yeah.
Making normal life happen for boys and girls.
Exactly. And it was from day one, I remember the first firefight we was in, it was at a place called Eastern Checkpoint, which was later changed to Balaclava, if people know that. I remember stood on top of this compound and before getting to the 26th of May, I got a bit off piece, sorry, Ben. But yeah, that was one of the first firefights in I had.
This is your two-way range moment.
Yeah, yeah. And it was just ba 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 bam. And I remember going, and I thinking, oh shit, is that someone shooting? And I had to turn and go, Sergeant Clark, someone shooting? And he goes, yeah, yeah. And we returned fire. But then it gradually become a daily occurrence in a firefight. So,
an enemy that you can see?
Sort of. Every now and then, Taliban were very good at hiding and got later known as very good at putting rounds down the range and then moving somewhere else, rounds down the range, moving again. But anyway, leading on to the patrol, I remember having a team briefing and we was going to go out and just do a, not an advance to contact, but a routine patrol in some area, in a place called Frog Eyes, where some Taliban had been seen. And we're going to go out and have a look about, basically. Clearing compounds, kicking in doors, say as you will. And my story is probably different to other people's stories, but this is how I remember it. And then there's like the book called The Killing Zone, which is written as well, which is a different story about it. And then other people have said different ways, but there's probably 100 different stories, but they all combine into one sort of final one, which is very similar. But the way I remember it, we went out.
This is just you as a platoon.
This is just me as a platoon, yeah.
Yeah. This is a platoon commander and you guys are on your own.
Yeah.
Out on the ground.
Yeah.
26, 28 guys.
Yeah.
Moving in three sections.
Yeah. That's it. And then there was a guardsman, Daniel Probin, who was the lead man. He was probably he is the best soldier I've ever served with. Myself, just behind him, the LMG gunner. And then the rest of the section at the back, basically, just... and a patrol. Not really much happening. And then we was going to peel in onto this position and put...
Sorry, what time of... this is you going out at night?
Yeah, it's about night. So it's around... I'd say it's probably around about 2200 hours in the evening. Is that, I think that's the time.
That's 10 o'clock for you civvies that don't understand.
Yeah, 10 o'clock, yeah. 10 o'clock in the evening. Roughly, I think that's the time.
Whatever, it's the sun's going down.
So we go out and then we were going to peel into onto this sort of like irrigation ditch, like a bomb crater, to put some rounds down. At this point, we'd just been engaged by the Taliban.
Okay, so the contact begins.
Yeah.
They know you're coming.
Yeah.
You're working out how you're going to, because you're going to advance the contact. You want to take them on now. You're not just sitting there in a base letting it happen.
Yeah.
You're going, we're getting amongst them now.
Yeah. So there was probably stuff prior to that, but that stuff kind of loses me. I kind of, really phasey, the actual walk out. I can't remember if we walked up the river or if we walked straight up no man's land. It sort of surpasses me, that information. I can't really remember it.
It's been deleted.
Yeah. And then so the engagement happened and me and Dan were the two guys who were peeling around into the irrigation ditch. So the section then peeled into this.
So you and Danny probing?
Yeah.
Because he's the point guy, right?
Yeah.
So you're a GPMG gunner, which is like
jump purpose machine gun.
Yeah. For those of you that are not aware of what one of those is, that's a big belt fed machine gun. Weighs a bit heavier than everything else around. Spits out 7.62. It's that archetypal big force multiplier, I think you'd say.
Yeah.
It's a good piece of kit.
Great bit of kit, the general.
Yeah.
It's
the
just,
general.
It never stops working.
Yeah.
So I had that and we peeled in and started putting brass down. And then it was all engagement. Everything's going on. RPGs coming in. Rounds coming over heads. I remember turning to my right and looking at Guardsman O'Sullivan. And then seeing him with the ILAW, which is like a, for guys who don't know, it's basically, it's like an RPG basically. He had that ready to go and to put into this compound where we
so this is firing a rocket into the compound. Big,
yeah.
Like a 66, but a bit bigger.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. So he was about to fire that. I turned to my left and Dan was just next to me. And then I remember putting my head down and then kaboom. It just from underneath is just completely blew up.
So the position that you're inhabiting erupts.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's just... and if you don't know about being blown up, you put your fingers in your ears and you close your mouth and you hum. It was basically very dazed what had just gone on. And I got blown on top of the ditch and there was just mud and dust and I can hear like slow thump, thump, which is the rounds coming over our heads. I remember then trying to reach down to grab my leg and it'd been... I can't describe the pain. It's like the pain was that intense. It was like having no pain, but at the same time, it been felt like I'd been hit by a train. And I just...
So you... Are you all lying down, prone position?
Yeah, sort of.
Kneeling behind a bank?
Kind of just lying in a kneeling position.
So this isn't a pressure pad that one of you's hit?
No,
this is a pre-set up...
Yeah.
Bunch of IEDs. Command wire?
Command wire, so they said that in a daisy chain position is what I was told.
Sorry, in a daisy chain. So for the listener, that means that there are lots of IEDs, improvised explosive devices, all joined together.
Multiple, yeah.
Designed to go off either together or simultaneously. And when we say by command wire, we mean that somewhere there is somebody on the end of a wire putting down the archetypal,
yeah,
bit like the cartoon plunger, yeah, to make it go off. So it's not something you've triggered yourself with a trip wire or a foot, you know, pressure pad. This is
preemptive, yeah.
They're preempted. They are taking a bet that this is where, if they engage you, you're all going to end up taking cover, and then we're going for you.
Yeah, they must have seen, they've been watching us for months, obviously. They've contacted us for months. The other platoons out there, two and one, they must have seen them do the same. And they just preempted it. And they, as far as I'm aware, that's what happened. I mean, like I said, my memory of it is not too the same. But so, yeah, they day chained it. And I remember being, so I was on top of the ditch. And I remember
This thing goes bang, and your next conscious moment is,
I'm lying on my side, on my left side, on the ditch, and I remember falling onto my back and trying to reach down and grab on my leg, and then put my, like, on my hand through my kind of knee / nothing, and just screaming, this, like, blood-curdling scream that I just, because I was in the agony of the pain, I can't describe. And I'm sorry for the men who later on now suffer with PTSD, remember that scream. I apologise for that. But it's...
I'm not sure that's something you have to apologise for. It is what it is. It's horrific.
They're letting the blokes down. That was the scream. And that's when they then engaged us proper. They went full-on attack mode.
Because they know that...
They know that guys are injured. And it's not my fault. And
people will start coming.
So luckily in the rear we had not just our platoon, but we had guys there who were like the QRF and the rest of the platoon, rest of the sections.
So you've worked out that you're injured. You're not fully aware of the full extent yet.
No.
The rounds are still coming in. Are you trying to now move into cover, or are you just going, I can't do anything, I'm just in agony?
So, yeah, I was kind of starting to move, and then Sergeant Scott Ruffley was then, I think he may have been the one who grabbed me first and pulled me back into the ditch.
Yeah.
To avoid the firefight and
start getting some first aid going.
Yeah, so I think it was him who put the tourniquet on me.
So he's your section commander, is he?
No. So he was another my section commander was a Prince of Wales lad who was Paul Morgan, who was there as well, but he was injured as well. So the whole thing,
the whole section, what? There's you.
Yeah.
What's happened to everyone else?
So there's been, unfortunately, Dan was killed.
He's killed in this explosion.
Yeah.
And he's next to you.
He's next to me, yeah. And then,
yeah. The man with his...
So his son, he just got injured, got shrapnel wounds to his side. Nick Davis then was another grenadier, lost his leg, and multiple blast injuries to his back of himself. Paul broke his femur and shrapnel wounds to his face. And then Dan Langridge was probably the only one who walked away.
Was he right on the end?
Yeah. And I say walked away, probably the memories of it probably don't do him any good. Or he was suffering with that. But he was my best man at my wedding, and Sullivan were. They're two of my best mates.
And so at that section, only one guy is unscathed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, clearly... You know, mentally, maybe not so, but physically, the rest of you are all injured. So there isn't the usual, like there has been in maybe some of the other incidents that this podcast have explored, where somebody comes up, he's a medic from the team, his mate next door to him, whatever. You're all taken out.
Yeah.
So somebody else is section or QRF or whatever appears on the scene.
Yeah.
And there's quite a few of you. That's five of you. Well, I suppose probing, they've worked out.
I don't really know. I mean, I probably don't want to go in too much into it.
No.
But, they tried their best at the time.
For sure. So the cavalry arrives. There's a firefight still going on. They get you all in the ditch and start working out
who's injured, what we're doing, where we're breaking contact, where's the contact coming from.
Somebody's...
Can we get fast air up? Can we get heli up? There's everything going on. And I remember just along my back and Rod was like, Scott's screaming. And I was like, okay. And I remember gritting my teeth and they put the tourniquet on. At this point, I didn't even know my arm was bad. And because it was like tucked under my body armour. In like it blown up and
okay, so you're not aware of that.
Didn't aware of that, and it was just chaotic.
Yeah,
and I can't. It's mad that. So I can't remember it. I can remember bits, and I can remember very vague bits. But I remember the firefight coming. I remember the javelins, the RPGs coming in. I remember the guys returning fire, and there must have been. Of stuff going on in the background, which I was one aware of.
Somebody slams a bit of morphine into you?
Yeah, get the morphine in, tourniquet on, and I remember saying about, we had screech, which is, people don't know, is basically...
The army equivalent of coat of, well, sort of fizzy aid.
Yeah, it's like in a packet, you shake it, and you put it in your water, and it turns into like a...
Orangey,
hydration, basically.
Yeah.
I remember going... I remember shouting, going, give me some of that screech. And I was there, and I was, because I was high on morphine. And then, out of nowhere, this godlike figure called Darren Chan runs up. And kind of, like, the way I remember it, which is probably incorrect, was, what's going on here then? Right, the enemy are over there. This is where we're breaking contact. This is what we're doing. He's going on my shoulders. He's going on the ladder. Put him in the poncho. Let's go. And it was kind of like that, I think. I may be 100% wrong.
That would... Daz and I worked together many, many moons before that. That would be how he would do it, wouldn't it?
I mean, think so, yeah.
So he's the drill sergeant at the time. He's appeared on the scene. He just happens to be in the neighbourhood.
I don't even know what he was doing there or how he got there, because I can't remember that.
But he starts gripping everything, and he decides that he's picking you up.
Picks me up.
And you're in contact.
In contact. In heavy contact as well, so I've been told. And
it's effective enemy fire.
Real effect, yeah. How everyone got injured on the extraction, I don't know. And anyway, he picks me up, puts me on his shoulders, and then with Captain Tien, who was the best platoon commander...
You'd ever had.
Ever have. And I'd follow him to battle now. Man was an absolute legend. And he still is. Anyway, Darren Chan puts me on his shoulders, and then let's get out of here, and just runs, takes off. And I remember being on his back. At this point, I knew I was aware I lost my leg, because when Rodders going back to when I got blown up, when Scott roughly pulled me back, my left foot came with me, but my right foot kind of stayed where it was, and then fell in the ditch just after. Anyway, Yeah, that's the only way I can describe it.
From the sublime to the ridiculous. Yeah.
Anyway, so Daz Chance got me on his back and he's running to the riverbed for the extraction. And then we get there and he puts me down kind of halfway, has a chat to Captain Tien and kind of decides where we're going to land the HLS. Can we do it here? Can we do it there? At this point, we're still in heavy contact. I can hear the rounds coming back. And anyway, we get to the riverbed and we get to a attack hill. Where I'm putting the back of a Pims and the doctors there. And
so they managed to get a Chinook in there, did they?
No, so we then drove up through the village and landed in a HLS area where they'd cleared away from, obviously, the contact, because at this point they crashed the rest of the platoon out, rest of the company, sorry,
yeah,
and gone on and finished that firefight, so far I was aware.
So this sort of, not to put too fine a point on it, but the flash, the bang time, from you getting in that Mert to Daz getting you to that LHS from when you get blown up, are we talking, I mean, is this half an hour?
I don't know.
You have no
idea. I can't remember the time of it. It felt like hours.
Yeah. I'll bet.
And I remember laying in the back of this Pimm's and the doctor's drilling.
A Pimm's?
So like a, not a drink. So it's a little wagon.
Okay.
Kind of, I'd say it's a really, really miniature like a lorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like a little pickup.
Like a little pickup truck. Yeah. Okay.
And they've got you in the back of that.
In the back of that.
Along with the other injured.
No, so just myself. So uh-huh. Darren Chance there. Daz Chance still in this back of the van with me. I can't remember who else is in there. But the faces, I remember the faces, the guys and the doctors there, and he's drilling into my shin and my left leg to get fluid into me. And that was excruciating. That was a wreck.
So this is your good leg?
This is my good leg. By that point, all the most of the morphine wore off.
This is to get fluids into you to stop you from going into shock because yeah. You've lost a lot of blood and fluids. Why aren't they trying to pump it into your arm?
I don't know. But I think my veins may have collapsed or whatever was going on.
He's got a drill, I'm going to use it.
I remember drilling it, and there's pictures of my leg and stuff you can find. And he's gone into it, and that was horrendous. Really bad.
Okay.
And then we got put on the Chinook. And I remember, like,
all of you, presumably, all of us,
Captain Tim was like, "You're going to be okay, keep fighting, mate, you're fine." And they put me in the back of the truck, and then I was next to Dan, and then Nick and everyone else got put on, and so he got put on after, because he only recognised he was bleeding until he got to the HLS, and then he got took out as well. So he did all that extraction, helped guys get out, and didn't realise he was injured. Warrior, fucking proper soldier.
Oh.
Yeah.
You all are.
And that was the last thing I remember. I remember
they put you to sleep.
I remember lying on the back of that truck going, holding my mate's hand, holding my friend's hand.
Who?
And Paul's.
Yeah.
And then Dan was next to me and I was like, and I remember watching them trying to do CPR and stuff. And then from that, that's the last thing I remember. I woke up in Bastion with OH and Ross Kemp in my bed. Yeah.
OH.
O'Hanahan.
Okay.
So he was the pay bloke at the time for Free Company.
Okay. And Ross Kemp.
And Ross Kemp, yeah.
You're thinking, what am I doing here?
What am I doing here? And I slagged, I apparently said about, oh, the SAS programme was naff, mate. Like, it was like, listen, go and soldier on, and whatever he was doing. Like, I can't remember, but Ash had pictures took with him and he was there because he was filming at that point. He was doing stuff in Afghanistan with the ambulance.
Okay.
And that was basically the night. I may have got that all wrong. Like I said, there's loads of different stories. But
and then you drift back out again and it's wake up in Birmingham.
Wake up in Selly Oak, which is now like a housing estate, yeah.
Yeah. You wake up in Selly Oak and when do you become aware of your injuries? As in the extent of, okay, you know you've lost a leg.
Yeah.
You've left a foot on top of the ditch. Well, what about the other stuff? When did that begin to come to you? Is this when you get to Selly Oak? Bastion? Or?
Yeah. Well, I knew my arm was bad. And then I kind of was aware that it's like I said, it's a bit of a blur. It's so long ago. It's 16 years this year, which is crazy to think of. So in Bastion, I knew I was banged up. I knew my leg had gone and I didn't really know the extent of my arm injuries. The blast wounds are pretty bad. I mean, out on the ground, apparently my hand was on my elbow and my elbow joint was sticking out like a good foot. And someone stood on it and then pulled it back into socket by accident. But it happened because it was dangling three. So they tried to extract me that way because I was putting a poncho to begin with and they didn't do that. And that's when Dan's chant appeared.
Yeah.
But yeah, when I was in Bastion, I was aware because I had a big cage on my arm from my hand all the way up to my shoulder. Like okay. A huge cage of pins and plates and everything.
Yeah.
So originally I was going to amputate it and get rid of it, but a TA surgeon saved it. And it's what it is today. It's great. It doesn't be good. I still do everything I want to do.
Well, we'll talk about that later. So from top to bottom, what are the injuries?
Right leg above the amputation.
Yeah.
Sedentary shrapnel wounds throughout my like sort of leg and lower back and arm. And then blast wounds to my right elbow, which is For the listener who can't see, I have not really got an elbow. I've got a big chunk of nothing.
Yeah.
Which is there, which is all scar tissue and grafts and everything else. Right eye, right ear, and then it's a soft tissue brain injury, whatever that is. But
a bit of sort of compression and
yeah.
blast,
yeah.
shockwave, the whole. Okay, but you haven't lost your eyesight?
Partial eyesight in that right eye. There's shrapnel wounds to it, which okay. are a little bit bad. I was all cut up and bleeding through that. So.
Right. So the end result of this nightmare evening is that five guys out of that six-man section are all now back in Selly Oak, or did some of them manage to go back out in the field, or yeah, are you all taken out?
I think it was all taken out. I'm not really aware of what happened to Sully and Paul, because I didn't see them in hospital as far as I remember. Nick okay. was in the bed opposite me, and that time where we got injured in
he's the other one who lost a leg.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another great soldier, legend, Nick, Queen's Company lad.
Yeah.
Brilliant soldier.
And when do you discover that Danny Probyn is dead?
So they told, Silly told me in Selly Oak, in Bastion.
Right. Luckily, you go to sleep and wake up in Selly Oak.
Yeah. And I mean, I remember just being in tears. I remember crying. I still do now. Think about it. It's horrendous. And everyone who you speak to will tell you how hard of a he was nails. He would have gone on and done great things. He would have been Hereford. He would have been up the ranks. He would have been.
He was your main man. Was he sort of, had he been in a bit longer than you?
Was he
was your sort of senior guardsman, was he?
He was, yeah. And but there's no words to describe how great of a soldier he was. You can't.
You all looked up at him and went,
massively.
That's what I want to be.
Massively.
Yeah. Did you ever see Daz again?
Yeah. So I didn't see him until I got back to battalion. After I was kind of like rehabilitated in a way.
Okay. So much, much later, months later, unless when they're all back from the tour.
Yeah, unless he'd come in to visit me, which I can't remember. I had so many people for that stage of hospital from operations from like 37 or 38, whatever it was, maybe in the 40s, operations to different
while parts. While you're at Selly Oak, yeah. just getting patched up.
So he may have done.
Yeah.
I can't really remember. But yeah, that 8 weeks to 9 weeks in the hospital from that point, yeah, it was pretty full on. And like I said, there was not many of us. There was me and Nick, who and the guy was another PWR lad who had been shot through the knee. We were the only soldiers in that ward at that time. The rest of it were civilians.
Because this is quite early on in the whole sort of campaign.
Yeah.
So the mass numbers of casualties pitching up every day hasn't quite
hit off. Yeah. Nothing really. They weren't expecting the casualties they were expecting. And that's a different sort of story to go into and probably a different podcast. But they had no, they weren't prepared, I don't think, at all.
It becomes a very slick operation from battlefield to, you know, Selly Oak, you know, back in Birmingham, whatever, and you listen to the other podcasts and it's like, wow, that is unbelievable. And you guys were sort of that first, almost like the guinea pigs at the beginning, where it's like, whoa, okay, so we get you back to Bastion and then we go from there.
Yeah.
But from the result of your incident, I know there was a huge amount of learning done from
massively.
It insofar of, okay, so this is what's going to happen. And what we've discovered is if we get that team on a MERT team in that Chinook, actually, you got a good chance of making it.
Yeah.
If you can get to that point.
Yeah.
And then it was pretty slick thereafter.
I think so, yeah. That's
so a lot of learning done.
Massively, and for the better.
Oh, for sure.
For guys who...
But that's what the military's brilliant at, isn't it?
Improvise, adapt and overcome everything. And that's what they do really well. And when I first got told I was going to Headley Court, I was like, and like you listened, probably heard about Headley Court. And I was like, what? I mean, the RAF base. And they were like, no, it's a rehabilitation centre. I went, yeah, for RAF guys, right? Who have like paper cuts. Why am I going there? I mean, sorry if you're RAF, but that's the way I thought of it. And that's the way I was told. And yeah,
paper cuts for the RAF. That's very damning.
I do apologise, and you welcome to the comments.
It's all
good. It's just banter. But yeah, when I got there, there was a few para lads, amputees who'd been injured in Kajaki.
Yeah.
Me, Nick Davis, and then a guy called Nick Brennan who's in Iraq. And that was it. It was like five, six blokes. And prior to that, Afghanistan had all been shotgun wounds and all round-to-round combat, proper infantry engagements.
Yeah.
And that was what we was doing for a day on a daily basis.
Yeah.
I mean, and round-to-round fighting, engaging with the enemy, proper infantry skills. And from after that, we were one of the first sections or first army sections to be hit with the IED in Afghanistan.
Yeah. And then a whole new learning had to take place.
A whole new learning curve after that.
Which I guess a lot of it had been forgotten. I remember your commanding officer at the time, Carew Hatherley, he and I were in South Armagh together. It was 10, 15 years before this event, you know, early 90s, where the IED was, you know, it was a big threat. And, and we were learning every day and all of that stuff was going on.
Yeah.
And it was very much part of the infantry skill set. Then not setting patterns, mm-hmm. making sure everything, every time you went out was different because they just watched. And the minute that was it, they could get you. And they were good at it. And I guess, you know, the Taliban sort of clocked on and went, this is how you can really slow down a much bigger force. But of course, not a lot of Northern Ireland stuff. It's all in the rearview mirror. You guys were all joining in 2004 and that's something for the history books for you guys.
Yeah.
So it was new and then it kicked off and then of course it became the main event. Let's now fast forward. You get patched up.
Yeah.
And because you're one of the first, you're actually still employed in the regiment and you'll go back to serve.
Yeah.
So you're not medically discharged and that's it. Thanks very much. Here's your pension. A couple of medals on your chest. You're back in uniform.
Mm-hmm.
How was that? I guess you're the only one, right? I mean, there's only two or three of you wandering around going, is this how it works now?
Yeah, yeah. And they wanted to keep us in somewhere. And I kind of wanted to stay in because that's all I knew.
So quite good for your mental health to be in amongst the gang.
Yeah. And
so what job have they got you on, bearing in mind that you...
Yeah, I don't think the regiment kind of knew. I don't think most of the army quite knew what to do. And I think they were very good at going, we love to have you, keep you in. Let's see what you can do down the line. Let's put you in the stores where you can sit down, still see the blokes. And it was that routine. And I didn't mind that. I was around the men. And that's what I loved. I was around my mates and my family. My brother. Still living the block, still going out on the drink and enjoying it. And back and forth from head to court. So... with numerous things and operations and everything else. And it kind of get lost. I kind of got lost within that sort of system where sometimes the regiment didn't know where I was. Sometimes I was at home because I'd been put on sick leave from Headley Court and vice versa. And it was
a big learning curve for everybody in the whole system. Yeah. Huge. The whole MOD is trying to work out what we're going to do with all these people.
Yeah. So I went down like to go to like being a postman in the regiment. That didn't really kind of worked out. I kind of didn't really like it. I was with some civilians who I didn't really get on with. Didn't last long at all. Into the stores, which lasted quite a while, which I really liked. An income company, which is brilliant. And then headquarter company as well within that. And then Netherwall Barracks, where I was based there. And then I did my kind of like point where I kind of changed and started doing charity stuff and...
So let's get on to the extraordinary journey then. You're still in the army.
Yeah.
But you did do something whilst you were in the army, which had never been done in 900 years or something. You actually, one of the first things you did was 2010, I think.
Yeah, that's it.
You're the first amputee guardsman to do a ceremonial duty.
Yeah, it's the back on guard at the Tower of London. Yeah.
So that's great coat, bare skin.
Yeah.
Standing to attention in a sentry box at the Tower of London.
Yeah.
Pacing
pacing up and down.
Oh, I didn't pace.
Paul, who goes there?
Yeah.
You didn't pace.
I didn't pace.
You didn't do any marching.
No, I didn't do any marching.
How did you get to your post?
I did a little bit marching, from the door to the post.
Slipping on the old cobbles.
Yeah, shoes on and the lot. I loved it. It was great actually to do that, and
because
I'm so glad
you're a guardsman. So bullying the old boots.
Yeah.
I felt like home.
Yeah.
And you're on guard.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, the person who's the tourist looking at you has no idea.
No.
Because you're just standing there in a uniform like everyone else.
In greatcoat, yeah.
Magic. And probably not being done since. I mean, because they don't.
I don't think so. I think I'm the only one. So, do you
ceremony of the keys in the evening?
I did that.
They didn't let you march to the steps and start.
No. In case I ran off of my leg, I think. But no, stood guard. Yeah, it made national news, Tower of Strength, whatever they called it. And I just wanted to show the blokes that, I can do it. I mean, don't leave me down and out. I'm still here.
So that's amazing. So you did that. You'd done the London Marathon in 2009, a year before.
Yeah, a team of us, yeah.
A team of you. What? So did you run the whole thing or just a bit of it?
Just a bit of it.
But the team of you are all...
all injured servicemen, yeah.
And you nailed that in 7 hours or something?
Well, I think it was a little bit longer than that, but...
but, yeah.
So, but
you then swam a channel?
Yeah, it's a relay, yeah. Me and a rough reg lad.
What, just two of you?
Yeah. And then took it in turns.
What, sort of hour on, hour off?
Yeah.
Swam the channel. Okay. That's not easy, even fully limbed up.
Yeah, it's just very wet and cold.
Yeah, for sure, but... You're kicking like twice the man because you've only got one leg, right?
I was going around the circles for the first hour.
I'll bet. Okay, so you start doing extraordinary things and you're raising money. Which charities are you doing these things for?
So the first one's for Heroes, so the London Marathon. You might know actually Mike Elliott.
Mark was in the regiment when I was serving, and was sort of.
So he was a big benefactor of that. And then the relay across the channel, the group of us, was for Battle Back. Not Battle Back Golf, but the itself Battle Back, which is a big programme, and the separate ones that run off from that.
Yeah.
So that was for that. Like I said, that was a big team of us, but me and Mike were the two injured guys.
And then keep sort of moving this along. 2014, you row... across the Atlantic.
Yeah.
As part of that big event that still happens every year now.
Yeah. So the, at the time it was every 2 years, so the Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge. Bit of a mouthful to stay once you've had a lot of Talisker Whiskey. Yeah. But yeah,
how many of you in the boat?
Four of us. So me and Cale Royce are the two injured guys.
Uh-huh.
Mark Jenkins and then James Cale.
So we all Grenadiers?
No. Like... So all different backgrounds, all ex-military. Yeah.
And who put that together?
Do you know what? I don't really know.
I mean, how did you get in the boat?
Got a phone call off Mark Jenks, who was a physio from Headley Court, and he knew I was man enough to go, yeah, sure, I'll do that.
Because it's 48 days or something.
Well, yeah, you want to think the average race lasts longer than 50 days, which is what you basically go for.
That's how many rations you're taking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We did it in 48 days.
And did you win?
No, so we come third overall and second in our class. So we were the second group of four.
Yeah. Just briefly, how was rowing across the Atlantic?
Same as probably swimming. Very wet and competitive. 2 hours on, 2 hours off, 4 hours at night. We start in La Gomera and you finish in Antigua in the Bahamas.
Yeah.
So it's a big old route.
But your body is holding up. I'm thinking about your arm here. You're pulling an oar and you've got one arm that is a lot smaller than the other.
Well, Cale had no hand. He's got no fingers on his right hand.
Okay.
And so we specialised like a bit of... like a sort of...
bolted him to the...
Like Velcro on top of his oar. Halfway across, so I got hit with a rave and I fractured my elbow in two places, which I didn't know. I just thought, oh, it's aching. I can't really straighten it. It's fine. And I don't. People always ask me about mentality. I'm very laid back and I'm very just like, yeah, this happens. And the first time I got in a boat, properly and rode was when we got to La Gomera. Prior to that, I was an ergo machine, which is a rowing machine.
So you didn't even know if you were seasick, where you were going to live.
I figured out what to do.
Yeah, somebody will work it out. Okay, because now everybody goes off, they do endless training, they go out and they row their boat around and they spend, you know, 48 hours, they live in it, they work out. Okay, maybe they're taking a slightly different approach to it. And
yeah, I mean, a massive approach. And I mean, James and Mark, they were both officers and they obviously was in the background doing a lot of the comms and
for sure.
And working everything out. Navigation. Yeah. We had waypoints which you'd row to every day from a navigator and our weatherman who would tell us which way to go and which route to take.
Yeah.
And
I know there's a whole machine. Yeah. But it's still quite extraordinary. You hadn't spent any time in a boat. No. I mean, you could have been the most seasick person ever, yeah. Which would have been an absolute train smash.
But then I did. Yeah.
You just overcome it anyway.
It sounds really bad, and it sounds like a people go, "Oh, you idiot," whatever. But yeah, I'm just that just. Crack on and deal with it. If it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, it doesn't. And yeah. It's that big odd saying, you write a list of the things, Dan, that you're worried about. You cross out the things that you can't deal with, like things that you mean you have no control over.
Yeah.
And you deal with things you can.
Yeah.
And that is the way I've always kind of thought about it. And I've always thought about that. I mean, just get up and crack on. And if your mind's to it, you're going to be fine.
You row the Atlantic, that's all still while you're in the army. 2015, you eventually go, or does the army say, look, because you're not going back on any tours, they're not sending you out, you're not deployable.
No, so by that point, I think Afghan had kind of really kicked off.
Yeah, it was
all IDs, and they needed guards on the ground, and everything else. And
lots more now,
and lots
following
more.
The same journey that you and... Unfortunately, you don't get to see Daz Chant again.
Yeah.
Because he gets killed.
Yeah. And then I was, so then that year, I was then militarily discharged from the army. Yeah.
So you're out. Any ideas about what you thought you might do?
Join the TA. No.
please let me in.
Yeah, let me do something. No idea. I kind of left with a sort of open mind going, I don't really know what to do. I don't know what route to take. I don't know what to go into.
Is PTSD something that you've experienced at this stage?
I suffered with flashbacks in my sleep where I'd relive my incident and other incidents as well. So... That was what kind of my biggest thing with night terrors as such, where I'd wake up in cold sweats and like fighting in my sleep and all that sort of stuff. So, and that was kind of affecting me for the day where you kind of like the 1,000-yard stare, as people say it now, or absent sieges as they're diagnosed with, where you're just looking through a wall. And so
you're
all of that.
You're a million miles away. Yeah.
So I had all of that.
Okay.
And that was kind of going on.
But you're having treatment?
Yeah, having treatment. Okay. Yep. Yeah. So everything's going fine. I mean, thinking back, I can't even remember my first job I went into, which I don't really...
But the army gives you a pension.
Yeah.
And they medically discharge you.
Yeah.
You presumably had some insurance.
Yeah.
You did the old PAX thing or whatever it was.
Yeah, so I had all that. That was all fine.
Did you get all the units you could?
I got all the units I could. Yeah.
So you come out and you're financially, you're all right.
Yeah.
Are you married at this stage?
No. Yeah.
Didn't you get married quite quickly after the Atlantic?
Yeah, so you got married after the Atlantic.
So you're leaving sort of married, no kids, and going, what do I do now?
Yeah, and I must try and speak to my wife. She probably know more than me. I was always a big, avid golfer.
Right.
And that probably go down that route in a second, but...
Yeah, well, this is where I want to end up with, you know.
Yeah.
What has led you to where...
So the guy we Google now
and what we see online.
So Battleback Golf was, and there's other golfers out there, like the On Course Foundation.
So that's a charity, Battleback Golf.
Battleback Golf is a charity. It's on Instagram if you want to follow it, Battleback Golf. On Course Foundation as well, another charity, another golf charity, if you're both interested in them. But in at Headley Court, a gentleman called Zima Gomez said, "Do you play golf?" And I said, "Oh, a little bit. I kind of do bits. I played a little bit in the regiment before I lost my leg." He said, "Oh, come to the golf range and enjoy it." And I was like, "Okay, yeah, no worries." So I did that and then just fell in love with it.
So let's put the listener out of their misery. You're a golfer now.
I am, yeah.
Would you say you're a golf pro?
I am.
So would I, but, you know, I just wanted to check.
So, yeah, so
PGA. So you're a golfer or you're a PGA?
PGA professional, yeah. So I'm in training still, in year two. I work at the Belfry and golf's always been part of my life. And prior to me and my wife, when I was in the regiment still, I was playing a bit of golf with my injury.
When did you know that not everybody can be a pro golfer. Did you play golf before you get injured?
Any little bit, but not massively.
But did you know you could hit a golf ball?
Yeah.
Quite a long way, relatively straight.
No, I'm not very long, but I hit it reasonably straight.
Okay. So fast forward, you're a golf pro now. You work at the Belfry. What do you do at the Belfry? Are you the sort of resident pro in the pro
shop? No. So I work in the pro shop and I do a lot of custom fit administration. So I work with the brands of the custom fitting side and order all the stock in and look after the customers is basically what I do in a nutshell.
Convince bad golfers like me that if I bought that driver, had just a little bit more flex,
yeah,
my game would be... It definitely so much would. Better.
It goes straighter, longer and further. Yeah.
Of course. But you're playing competitively on the circuit.
I am. So on the PGA sort of trainee pro tour, which they kind of go around the country. And yeah.
So do we have a ranking? How does it work?
So the last year I finished 47th on the order of merit. So you're playing the competitions and... I mean, I played dreadful in my first few competitions. I shot over par tons. I mean,
welcome to my world.
Horrendous golf.
Normally you guys are all hitting par and below.
Shooting under and shooting. Yeah, I mean.
So it takes a while for you to get your game together, but so you're 47th out of how?
So I think there was about probably 100, maybe 80 guys on the last year on the order of merit.
Okay. You're halfway up the field and everybody else is...
Well, got their limbs.
Able-bodied.
Yeah.
And you're coming along and you're spanking a golf ball with one leg and one arm that's not functioning the way a normal arm does.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're still going around in... I don't want to play golf with you. You're still going around in par.
I'd say just about for listeners, if people who know me, I get the ball from A to B.
Yeah.
And I love every minute. And it has saved my life. There's been bits in the past where I've been late for a tea time and mate's friend would ask where I was. And I was but that's a different story. But it's,
But that's the PTSD bit, is it?
Yeah.
And that's you going, I don't want to be around or I just don't want to be doing
this? Yeah, I just don't want to be around.
Okay.
And that my mate literally rang me up and goes, "Oh, you on your way?" I went, "Well, what's going on?" He goes, "We're going to be late for..." "Oh, sugar, yeah." And I remember chucking what I had in my hand and got in the car, got my clubs and went. And not since that day, I've not thought about it since. And I was another bat-back guy. I won't mention his name, but
chucking something out of your hand because you were going to try and finish yourself there, were you?
Yeah, that was prior to meeting Amy and everything else, but...
In the deep, dark days.
Yeah.
Wow, so golf, you went to the golf course and you've never looked back?
I never looked back.
That's pretty...
And since that day, and I don't know if it just snapped me out of it. It did snap me out of it, but...
That's a simple, phone call from a mate saying, "Get your ass down here, we've got a tea time."
I've never actually thanked him, but...
You just did.
Yeah, yeah. But it's back then, since I have not looked back since that day. Everyone struggles, don't get me wrong, but...
Okay, so you're a pro golfer, you work in the industry, you've got sponsorship, you do your thing.
Yeah.
There's one other thing that you do, because, you know, that's just not enough, is it? So Scott needs to do something else. So tell us about the other thing, which I think culminated in quite recently, you standing on the podium...
Why don't you tell us a bit about that?
So yeah, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which is...
So, like a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
Yeah, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which most people know is like an MMA, mixed martial arts. Okay, but not actual mixed martial arts. It's Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which is the ground-based martial art.
When you say ground-based...
So, a lot of it is all fought on the ground. So, imagine judo, but you both your break practically lying around on the floor, cuddling, trying to strangle or submit each other.
Okay. You're not holding on to each other's pyjamas.
Yeah, wearing pyjamas, your gi.
But it's, so you're not standing up. I mean, you start standing. And it's all about holds and manoeuvring your weight and body around and getting your partner on its back or in a position where you can get them to submit, right?
Yeah, submit.
So you're not striking. It's not striking.
Okay. So the basic rule is you've got to incapacitate your opponent.
Okay. And this is a sport that you do.
Yeah. It's a hobby, I suppose. Golf's a career.
Golf's a career, but you've got what you go and learn this in a gym, or you've been fighting all your life. So
No. So I have been fighting all my life, but in a different way. So yeah. Jiu-Jitsu was bought by my cousin Jake Blaney, who was another Grenadier Guard, who did it throughout the army and did it for the army. And he was like, "Oh, I should come along one night, give it a go." Another thing to help your mental health, get some steam off.
Yeah.
And it was great. And I went down to the local, the gym, the dojo in the Neaton, which is called Blood, Sweat and Tears. And Andrew Ramos, BJJ. And yeah, it was great. And then it was fantastic. You get hooked so quick.
So you get into it, you learn your craft, and this is culminated in...
Yeah, so then I competed at the World Championships 2023.
Able?
No, so para, the first para World Championships. My first, sorry.
Where did you come in that?
So second, so won silver medal. World silver medal.
So this is a sport you've been doing a couple of years?
Since probably post-COVID.
And you just got a silver medal and representing Team GB.
Yeah, Great Britain, yeah.
You get a silver medal and... You don't, I mean, this might be a dumb question, but you don't go out there with your prosthetic.
No, take it off. So you fight, I take my prosthetic off.
So do people, other injured people, are you fighting somebody with the same injury as you?
Yeah, so it's all done on injury, it's basically done on your...
So you're not going to come across somebody with two legs?
No, only when I've been fighting other body people.
Okay.
So in different competitions, I've fought in different tournaments, I've fought other body guys because there's been no disabled...
To beat them?
Yeah. I've won medals and silvers and bronze. And...
I'm just thinking what that must be like.
It freaks
as
me out.
As I come out and I'm thinking, well, he's only got one leg.
And I take my leg off. I put it on one side.
And I'm thinking, oh, I've definitely got this bloke. He's only got one leg and his arm's looking a bit. And then you whop me. Okay, I get it. Very satisfying.
Yeah. I mean, it freaks them out, but it's...
I bet because it's a whole different weight and manoeuvre and how am I going to deal with this
problem? They don't really know, I suppose, and they can panic and everything else, but it's a great sport. So, yeah, so I've gone on, been selected for GB.
And is that...
Abu Dhabi.
What's that? Is that next Olympics?
It was going to be in the Olympics. Hopefully, they're going to be in the next one, but Abu Dhabi was where the World Championships was.
Okay, so... It's not going to be in Paris next year.
No.
It's not a Paralympic sport yet.
No.
But could be.
Could be.
Will you still be another 4 years?
I'd still be around.
Yeah. What are you, 37?
Yeah.
41. It's worth a crack, isn't
it? Worth a crack.
Amazing. We could, as you said earlier on several moments, there's another whole podcast about so many of these things. But I'm hoping the listener is getting a feeling of Scott is doing some extraordinary things. Can we just talk a bit about now the charities that have been of benefit to you and the difference that those have made to you? The charities that have, I think when we chatted earlier, you talked about obviously the Regimental Colonel's Fund.
Yeah.
If you could talk us through a bit about what that does for you and Blesma.
Bless me, yeah.
And then your battle back.
So, Colonel's Fund's always been there. and it's always helped me. Matt Almer does a fantastic job of the Red Big Coffee Officer.
And you're still part of that network?
Part of the network. And then, so they help pay for my PGA, my tuition for that.
Okay.
The Colonel's Fund.
Right.
As a charity. Yeah. And help me each year with that. So...
Because that's quite a big ticket item, is it?
Yeah. Grateful was the wrong word. I don't know what word I could use as above grateful. I mean, there isn't, I think. And
well, I think that's a fine word because it's, you know...
To allow me to continue and have a career and stand out from the crowd, the Kerner Fund has done that.
And that's why people donate to it.
Yeah.
Because it makes a real difference, right?
Massive difference.
Yeah. So that's pretty impressive. What was Blesma, presumably, so there?
Blesma is the British Limbless Ex-Servicemen's Association,
uh-huh.
which has been there since day one. So they come and visit me in hospital from little boxes of magazines and shower foam and bits and pieces like that. Blesma is always that sort of charity where you can be on the end of the phone, ring someone up, and they'll be there to help you. And there's grants and stuff they help, and there's charity days.
Do they help with your prosthetic, getting the right one made or so fitted?
So they can help you with numerous different things, from PTSD to getting it booked into a proper prosthetic clinic, uh-huh. and stuff like that, and visitors, and helping fill out forms, and people who are elderly. So you're talking like World War II vets or amputees.
Yeah, yeah.
They're still around for them.
Yeah.
And they're brilliant. And they host like charity days, and they can aid you with like adaptations to your house, yeah. and to your drive, and everything. They're fantastic what they do. They are really good. They've always been that charity. They've always, like I said, they've always been there.
Yeah.
Need something doing or need a bit of help. Definitely a charity to do it for. And they help fund the trip to Abu Dhabi for the World Championships for the GB team, for the two army lads, for me and Paul, who went out there. They help put money towards that for travel and expenses.
Yeah.
And so that was fantastic. And without that, I wouldn't be able to go to Abu Dhabi and compete. And it wasn't just like a jolly, it was a proper training camp. And
it's a world champs.
It's a world championships, yeah. So they helped me win that silver medal. So it's just as much theirs as mine. So.
And then Battleback Golf.
And that's just been there since I first lost my leg. That's the one charity that I every year I look forward to their schedule of golf comps, because the blokes who play on that mini tour, brilliant. They've all got the same injuries in a way, and they've all been through the mud, been through the blood, and they it's brilliant. That is one charity that does a great lot of good as well.
That's your champion sort of. Well, golf is your thing now, right?
Golf's my thing. All three. There's countless of charities that do great around the world.
Yeah. But those are the three that you...
I adore with love and care and everything.
And you're putting... I mean, you've done all these events where, it's normally everybody else goes out and runs a marathon to raise money for the charities, to give money to guys like you, but you're going out and raising, swimming the channel, running marathons, rowing the Atlantic... It's all raising funds for these charities.
Yeah.
That you're the beneficiary of.
Yeah, I've not done much stints to raise money, but I mean, they're the sort of ones in the past, but representing them, and happy to say that I'm an ambassador, or in the future to be an ambassador for them.
Yeah.
I always tell people about them. As you can see, I've got a Bless My Band on, but I'm always raving about them and saying what good they do.
Uh-huh.
So.
The place you're in now, getting on with your golf,
mm-hmm.
that career, what's the goal there?
So finish the PGA is going to be the big one. And then hopefully maybe be a head pro at a club or go down that route. I don't really know. At the minute, there's no end goal. I just want to get through the last year and a bit of my education with the PGA and complete that, and then who knows from there.
So that's your golf that occupies you, your Brazilian jiu-jitsu full on now, you've got young family, three kids. It's all full on.
It's all full on.
We're sat here amongst the laundry and the toys.
Yeah.
In the comfort of your home. Would you say Scott's in a good place now?
Oh, definitely. And don't get me wrong, there's up and down days and there's dark days to everything. And it can happen in a heartbeat, in a click.
Mm-hmm.
And you could be straight back there. But I'm in a great place. You know, a lot of that is down probably to my wife, who's very good at digging you out of the dark and being a very good pair of ears.
She can sense when the demons are rising.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing. Scott, thank you so much for sharing your story. A lot of it is pretty difficult, and apologies to the listener if you find some of that stuff at the beginning quite hard work, but that's the reality of war. It's the reality of what these guys go and do. You're incredibly generous and gracious with your views on the other guys around you. If you've got one headline, what would be the headline that you would like to leave the listener with about you?
The one that stands quite close to me and I kind of repeat and tell people is that challenges are what make life interesting, and overcoming them is what make life meaningful, and just keep on fighting.
I think that is a great place for us to leave it. Thank you very much indeed. That was Scott Blaney, formerly of the Grenadier Guards, now golf pro. Just Google him and you can find out if you need to know any more about the guy. The likes, the follows, those all mean so much for a podcast. So if those of you listeners, if you can like, if that's genuinely what you feel, follow, or the main thing is spread the word, get the message out there so that these charities really feel the benefit. And thank you again to all of those of you that have listened to these in the past and donated to the various charities. Scott's charities will be in the rider that accompany this podcast with various links to them. Thanks very much for listening, and look forward to seeing you at the next one.